Ron Van Dam, living proof that there is life after 40 for retired male strippers. Shake that thing, big dog, you still got it. You're listening to The Ron Van Dam Show on New England Broadcasting.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's The Ron Van Dam Show.
Okay, all right.
Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Welcome to the program of enormous proportions. Look at the size of this show, it's huge. How are you today? Sit back, relax, I'll take it from here. All right. I have a different kind of show today. Not that every show isn't different when I do it, but this is really different. I have a guest that's going to encompass the entire program. He's written a book about things that got messed up. He has examples of 100 of them, and it's in his new book. And it's kind of fascinating and kind of fun. So we're going to spend the show with him, if I may. Is that all right with you? No? Why not? Oh, it is all right. I'm sorry. I never read people well with body language. You were shaking your head, but I didn't know what that shake was. I thought you had a problem. Oh, that means yes. Okay, fine. All right. Okay. All right. Calm down. God. All right, let's say hello to our guest. Michael Smith is the founder, executive producer, and creative director of Beard Boy Productions. And he's done something that is kind of amusing and fun. And I got to find out how this got together. But he's done an audio book, which is called 100 of the Worst Ideas in History, Humanity's Thundering Brainstorms Turned Blundering Brain Farts, with riotous results. That's all part of the title?
It's a long title. It's actually 100 of the Worst Ideas in History. But yes, you also read the subtitle.
Yes. Thank you. Well, you know, does it appear on the cover?
It does, in fact, yes.
Okay, well, then it's part of the title.
Okay.
All right. There you go. That's the legal definition.
Thank you.
Just seeing that, I must read it. Because it's just fascinating. And thank you, by the way, for your title, telling me exactly what's going to be going on. I really do appreciate that.
Well, you know, so many books these days have this kind of esoteric title. You have no idea what the book is about.
Yeah.
This is a nonfiction, you know, look at some of mankind's most, astonishing faux pas, foibles, and foul-ups. So we thought we would actually say exactly what it is on the cover.
It's cool. I guess you could have called it What If. That would have worked, too.
Well, yeah, because a lot of these ideas seem like a good idea at the time, but over the course of their execution, not
right,
so much.
Right. And history doesn't know charm either, obviously.
No, it has no idea. Yeah. And Ron, we pulled from the world of politics, pop culture, business, fashion, sports, entertainment, from the recent past and distant past, and you know, these ideas are colossal and often laughably bad. I mean, some of them have started wars, sunk countries, wrecked companies, scuttled careers, lost millions, and even endangered the earth. So it's a pretty interesting exploration into those follow-ups.
Interesting. Even endangered the earth. Gone that far, which is true.
Yes.
I can pretty much in my head think of a lot of them. One of the topics that you brought up, which is something that is fascinating to me, is why do people mess up things that are working so well? And you referred to Coke going a different direction, and I'm thinking of Ford, like getting away from the Ford Taurus, which was the biggest selling car. I mean, like, why? Those are mysteries to me.
Well, it's one of those you can't leave well enough alone. And in the case of Coke, for instance, and this goes back to 1985, I can tell you about it here. And this is in the kind of what we call in the book the bubbly post-World War II affluence of America. And Coke is preferred by 60% of the market. Mm-hmm. Yet by 1983 or so, this pesky rival called Pepsi.
Yeah.
Has begun to outsell Coke among the younger people, the youth demographic, as they say.
Wow.
So Coke's market share that used to be 60% sunk to 24%.
Really?
So they started to panic a little bit. This is back in 1985, and Coke CEO Roberto Goizetta ordered a rethinking of the entire company's operation, even down to Coke's century-old formula. Wow. That got reevaluated, and it had always been this sort of stable sort of the real thing, they called it back in mm-hmm. those days, kind of a bastion of cool-headed product stability, and now they're sweating in the heat of competition, and they're ready to do the unthinkable, to change their taste.
Wow.
So Coke researchers fanned out across America. They're armed with trial samples of new Coke, as they call it,
mm-hmm.
a slightly sweeter, more Pepsi-like take on the traditional formula.
Mm-hmm.
And in blind taste tests, consumers choose new Coke over both Coke and Pepsi by wide margins. But in focus groups, where you get qualitative data, new Coke is met with far less enthusiasm, and still thirsty, shall we say, for a winner and to boost their margin of success from the past, new Coke is introduced, and immediately it goes from fizzy to flat.
Yeah.
Within days, the company receives over 400,000 distraught calls and angry letters. They bring in a psychiatrist to evaluate the tenor of these calls. And the psychiatrist said it sounds like people mourning the loss of a loved one.
Well, kind of.
Even Fidel Castro criticizes the move as another example of American decadence. And with boycotts looming just 3 months after its historic birth, new Coke is history.
Yeah.
And traditionally formulated Coke, now termed Coke Classic,
is
reintroduced. And so after millions of dollars spent, hundreds of millions actually, on testing and marketing new Coke, the executives conclude that they simply underestimated the public's deep and abiding emotional attachment to the original.
I remember when they started.
3 months.
Yeah.
Just 3 months.
And then they started putting them in the old Coke bottle, whether it was plastic or glass, it was still the old Coke bottle look from the outside.
Yeah.
So they really, and it's, you're in advertising marketing production.
Yes.
So this must be fascinating to you. And I do remember the slogan for Pepsi, for those who think young. And I guess that actually worked. Wow.
It worked for them. You know, you're right to say that this is of particular interest to me because it's something I've run into in my career for the past 30 years, which is there is a certain truth or idea that somebody has within a company. Everyone sitting around the conference table says, yes, that must be it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do enough. In this case, Coke did enough testing,
mm-hmm.
but they ignored the testing and said, no, we must do this because Pepsi is nipping at our heels. We've got to make a change after 100 years of the same formula.
Yeah.
We need to make this change. And it just blew up right in their face. Now, in the aftermath, some people thought that this was a conspiracy, that Coke had come up with this just as a way to scare people into thinking that original Coke was going to be taken off the off the market.
Interesting.
But there's really no evidence of that. And I know their CEO, Roberto Goizetta, later said, and I quote, "We are neither smart enough nor stupid enough to have come up with this conspiracy."
That is a smart CEO. That's okay.
Yeah.
The book also goes into some lighter things. Well, that's pretty light, but some lighter things and some heavier things, assassinations that could have possibly been avoided had certain protocols and things put in place. And then you also say in the book that what if Burt Reynolds, I guess, was offered the role of James Bond at a point. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. Burt Reynolds, was offered the iconic part of James Bond, and we call this story Smokey Not Stirred. And this goes back to 1972, and Burt, who, gosh, was one of my favorites, fresh from his star turn as the macho river adventurer, I think the character's name was Lewis in 1972's Deliverance,
mm-hmm.
Which was a Best Picture nominee.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he had this this buzz-inducing semi-nude spread in Cosmopolitan, which as a kid I remember seeing as well.
Yeah.
Bert was not really nude. He was mostly naked, except he had a catcher's mitt over a certain part of the male anatomy, shall we say. Okay. So that, you know, he was well covered.
Yeah.
But he's the hottest guy in Hollywood, and all scripts go through Bert at this point. So he's presented with the what we call the mother of all leading man roles, James Bond.
Yeah.
And in a mad scramble to secure, as they say, the dashing actor who can wear the tux, tote the pistol, and woo the girl, producer Albert Broccoli has Reynolds square in his sights.
Yeah.
But Reynolds says, listen, an American can't play that role. That's a British role. No American can play that role. I'm not going to play that role.
Huh.
And instead, he goes on to make such a cinematic classics as Fuzz, White Lightning, and The Man Who Loved Cat Dancing over the next few years. And so the jilted, I don't know if it's Broccoli or Broccoli. I say Broccoli.
It is Broccoli, actually. It is Broccoli.
Yeah, Broccoli.
Who actually did. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
They invented Broccoli.
Yeah.
So instead of Reynolds, they go for the savoir-faire, tongue-in-cheek Roger Moore.
Yeah.
To carry the Bond tradition forward, which is a billion-dollar bonanza that lasts 12 years. And in that time, Bert flexes his diminishing star power to make such forgettable flops as Gator, WW, and the Dixie Dance Kings in two Smokey and the Bandit gems.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not even close to what the Bond series.
Not even close.
So he says later on that... that he wakes up, he would wake up in the middle of the night and just say to himself, Bond, James Bond, and go back to sleep in a cold sweat. And he regretted it right up until his death.
And he should have.
He never took that role.
That would have been incredibly entertaining. I would have loved that.
He would have been great.
All right. Then we talk about assassinations that didn't necessarily have to happen if something small had occurred to prevent them.
We've got one here called A Confused Chauffeur Starts a World War. This is a very interesting one. This goes back to 1914, and it involves let's call it a tinderbox area of the world, Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, the former Yugoslavia. And it's an area the U.S. has been involved with over time, but especially in the 1990s. But anyway, this goes back to 1914. So Archduke Franz Ferdinand, who was heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which now controls this region, is parading through the streets of Sarajevo with his wife in an open-air limousine. And at the parade is a group of Serbians known as the Black Hand. Now, you hear that name and already you know it's not good, right? The Black Hand.
That sounds good.
And they do not like Franz Ferdinand. They don't like anything about the Austro-Hungarian Empire lording over their territory. So they get together and they make some bombs. And yes, back in those days, you had bomb throwers. You know, today that's a euphemism for anyone who takes a verbal pot shot at somebody. But back in 1914, you had guys who would gather up in a garage and make bombs and intend to throw them at people. So the Black Hand makes a bomb, and they are at the parade, and they toss it at Franz Ferdinand as his motorcade passes. It misses him. But it hits some of the spectators who are standing along the parade route and injures about 20 to 30 people. So out of the goodness of his heart, good old Franz decides later that day to visit these victims of the bomb blast in a nearby hospital and offer his support, condolences, whatever. And here comes the bad idea. So he instructs his limo driver to head for the hospital. The problem is the limo driver doesn't have a clue where it is. And there's no GPS or anything back in those days.
Right.
So the driver doesn't know where he's going. He takes a wrong turn, and he comes to what is essentially a dead stop on a dead-end street, and it's in front of a sandwich shop. Inside the sandwich shop is one of the would-be assassins from earlier that day, one of the bomb throwers. He's in there. He's chewing on a sandwich, you know, like a Subway place, and he looks out the window, and to his utter astonishment, he sees Franz Ferdinand sitting at a dead stop right there in front of him. The guy he was trying to get earlier that day is right there in front of him. So rather like Dirty Harry, if you remember the movie where he's got a hot dog in one hand and a Magnum in the other, he walks up to the car and sadly shoots both Franz Ferdinand and his wife and kills them both. And that assassination lights the powder keg that starts World War One, 24 million casualties in that war. So that one wrong turn responsible indirectly for 24 million casualties.
Wow.
That, now that's something.
That's bad timing on somebody's part.
Yeah, suppose. And it's the limo driver's fault. I always blame either the butler or the limo driver, is what they say. Now, the limo driver did it.
That's the book is fun, but now here's the twist. You've made this into an audio book, and why did you go that direction?
Because I'm one of those rare authors, I suppose, who is experienced in video and audio production. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of people. We're in Southern California. We've got a lot of friends who are voiceover people up in Hollywood. Uh-huh. So we brought them into the fold. We added some music and sound effects. Both my co-author Eric and I read some of the stories. I've got other voiceover people acting out and doing impressions and reading other stories. So it just made it, to me, a more entertaining presentation than simply the usual audiobook, which is a novelist standing in front of a microphone and reading it, you know, which goes on and on forever. I thought it would be more interesting. We're trying to breathe... Ron, we're trying to breathe new life into history. We know, for example, in schools, it's hardly taught these days. It's hardly, and the old adage is very true, that if you don't know history, you're damned to repeat it.
Yes.
And you see the same mistakes being made over and over again in history, and it doesn't have to be that way. And history can be interesting. It can be engaging. Yes. It can be instructive to a young mind, in particular, if it's not simply the usual recitation of dead guys and dates, as they call it. And this tends to not do that.
Your point is well made. I remember going to school, grade school, middle school, whatever you call that thing, and the teacher would stand up there and just rattle things off, and we were just looking at the clock, when is this going to be over? Day that he came in and like put a hat on when he was talking about Napoleon or something like that, or used some type of visual aid, all of a sudden we were engaged. That simple little extra dimension of theatrics worked. And it's great that you picked up on that, because that's really what we're talking about. It's adding another dimension to the presentation, and that does drill people into it. It's nice.
Yeah, it makes it more accessible, relatable.
It's a performance.
One of the things we're planning to do, Ron, is put together a traveling roadshow to go to schools with this idea.
Perfect.
And add visual representations.
Perfect.
Let it be interactive with asking questions, and being able to see that these are individuals who yes, had these ideas, and maybe they went wrong. We also have a section in the book, Bad Ideas Gone Good, where it started out as a bad idea, but actually ended up being good.
I guess it works the other way
around. But the idea here is to make it so that the individual watching, whether it be a middle school kid or high school kid, look at him and go, oh, that person is kind of like me. I have those thoughts or feelings sometimes too. Mm. So I'm going to listen, and I'm going to learn, and I'm going to maybe laugh along the way and be entertained.
That's nice.
So that's our goal. We're also donating audiobooks and printed books to schools locally here. For every sale we make, we give a book to a school. So we're doing our best. Is it a commercial enterprise? Sure, we'd like to sell books, but we also want to see if we can reinvigorate history learning throughout our area.
Yeah, I mean, there's one thing you said that I question these days. It was true, but now I'm not sure that if you don't know history, then you're doomed to repeat it. And unfortunately, we seem to be repeating it even though we're familiar with it now. And I could give you a lot of examples of that, but I'm sure I don't have to.
Oh, I think you're right about that. Yeah. So I guess that's ignorance in the broadest sense of the word. In other words, knowing it and then ignoring it. As opposed to never knowing it.
It's a question of what you do with information.
I think so. Yeah. I think that's definitely the case.
Yeah.
And isn't it important these days that we try not to keep repeating the same mistakes over and over again?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what the book's about.
There you go. Yeah, I'm still eating clams in months that don't end properly. So.
Well, that sounds like a very personal thing we should take up on another call.
Well, tell me lose weight under short periods of time. Anyway.
Well, do we have time for one more?
Yes, please.
I've got a couple here.
Please.
Let me tell you one. We're on the radio, so this involves a radio personality.
Alrighty.
And we call this one, this is under the chapter Major League Stupidity. And it's a sports section, mm-hmm. of course. And this one is called Disco Inferno Singes the White Sox. Mm-hmm. So it's July of 1979, and I guess I don't mind telling you, Ron, that I remember this one because I'm old enough to remember it. But we're at the high point of the platform shoe and polyester leisure suit era known as disco.
Yes, sir.
And as popular as disco was, in fact, I was a club DJ back in New York during this era, lots of people hated disco and the whole look at me disco attitude, especially diehard sports fans. So enter wild child Chicago disc jockey Steve Dahl, and he comes up with something called Disco Demolition Night. And here's how it works. You got to hear this. For just 98 cents plus a vinyl disco record, you get into a Chicago White Sox baseball doubleheader. And between games, Dahl collects the records and piles them up in the outfield, then uses explosives to blow them to smithereens. Now, that's not enough problem, but here's the real problem. Upon detonation, a crater forms in the outfield. Vinyl shards fly through the air like shrapnel. Oh, fire erupts. And fueled by booze and, shall we say, other stimulants, the disco-despising stadium crowd then spills onto the field. People out in the parking lot jump to turnstiles. Soon a full-scale riot is raging on the infield with fans wrecking batting cages, gouging the infield turf, burning banners. Scores of people are injured. Hundreds are arrested. Detroit Tiger manager at the time, Sparky Anderson, takes one look at the mayhem and refuses to allow his team onto the field for the second game of the doubleheader.
Good.
And the White Sox are forced to forfeit the second game, marking the last time in history an American League team has dealt an automatic loss. But this, Steve Dahl said later, I killed disco, and this event did it. He was very proud of it, even though it was complete mayhem and disaster.
Yeah, I wish he would have chosen a different form of music. but anyway... I saw a documentary about the Bee Gees, and apparently that apparently ruined their climb to fame, and disco started fading, and that was where they were at the time, but they had bounced back into other forms of music. But yeah, it was that serious and that hated really during that time, which is amazing in itself.
If you think about it, Ron, disco was only around, and again, unfortunately, it fell during my time as a DJ in clubs. I would rather have been playing the Stones and Beatles and stuff like that. But disco was really only popular from 77-ish to about 80, and maybe 81 if you're really pushing it.
Yeah.
So the Bee Gees putting all of their chips in that direction, going all in
it was a mistake.
On disco. Yeah. It did benefit them in the short term. If you remember, the soundtrack from Saturday Night Fever was, at the time, the biggest selling album of all time, and they had a lot of songs on it. But you're right, it pigeonholed them as a disco band, and they didn't really recover after that. I think Barry Gibb is still kicking around, but unfortunately his two brothers are gone.
Yeah. Yeah, but it brought out their biggest talent of all, which was songwriting. So that, there you go.
Yeah, they were good songwriters, for sure. No question about it.
Yeah, I wish they would have gone for a different form of music that apparently is still around today, and I don't really care for it. But anyway, that's no violence is no way to solve our musical problems.
Yes, you don't blow it up.
No, you don't blow it up.
You sit down, you talk about it, you try to compromise. You don't blow it up.
That's correct. did you have another example?
I do. I have a this one goes back in history a little further, and we call this one the president's scandalous embarrassment, if you pick up my unsubtle and crude meaning on that
sure
one.
Do.
And this gives crack of dawn a whole new meaning, Ron, because each morning, President John Quincy Adams sneaks down to the Potomac and undresses. And he proceeds to skinny dip.
Hello.
With the ducks and the geese, all the while, as we say, naked as a jaybird. A newspaper reporter named Anne Royal hears about it, and she hides out in the Potomac's foliage and catches the unsuspecting president in the buff. So she takes, this is all true, she takes his clothes and holds them ransom until he agrees to grant her a long-awaited interview. And he gets his clothes back, and she gets the interview. And she doesn't mention his, shall we say, ballsy morning escapades. But soon word gets out, as it always does in Washington. And now Adams is swimming in a pool of ridicule and shame. So as a result, his administration's policy agenda stalls, and he's soundly defeated for re-election in 1828 by Andrew Jackson. And in the end, the electorate considered Adams' sagging credibility and saggy backside and concluded that the emperor had no clothes. So, both, by the way, as a cherry on top of that cupcake, both Benjamin Franklin and later Teddy Roosevelt were also said to be big fans of skinny dipping. And I'm not sure your audience wants to have that mental picture in their mind go through their day, but that happens to be true.
Wow.
That's funny stuff.
That story has lent itself to more puns than
story. Yeah, I had about four of them in
at least four. and well done, too. Well done.
Oh, thank you. The crack of dawn was, my favorite one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I've got one more if there's time
for
it. We call this one E.T.'s Mission to Mars Aborted. So the year is 1981. And this bad idea comes from the chocolate-covered nuts, as we call them, at Mars Incorporated, the candy people.
Are you still doing the pun from the previous story?
I can't stop it, Ron. They're in me. They must come out. I'm an advertising writer by trade. I cannot stop it.
You can't stop it.
It just comes right out. So these chocolate-covered nuts, I'll say it again, right. Turned down perhaps the greatest product placement opportunity in movie history. So, Ron, I'm sure everybody in your audience, you included, me included, has seen the movie E.T., right?
Sure,
so
sure.
In the film, Elliot lures E.T., the extraterrestrial, out of hiding with a trail of candies. So E.T.'s producers approach Mars Incorporated for permission to use one of their products in the film. They figure a visitor from another planet would most likely be attracted to the most popular candy on Earth, which is M&M's. But the space cadets, there's another one, at Mars say no. They further state, we don't want an alien eating our candy. It's going to frighten children.
Yeah.
So that's a quote. That's an actual, if you can imagine the stupidity. But
sure.
So E.T.'s producers are now stuck and they scramble to find a replacement. And they stumble upon an obscure, largely unpopular candy Hershey has been struggling with called Reese's Pieces.
Mm.
And a deal is struck where Hershey agrees to pay absolutely nothing for placing Reese's Pieces in the film. They pay nothing. In exchange, they promote the movie and some of their own advertising for the candy.
I see.
Well, I think we all know that E.T. rockets past Star Wars to become the highest grossing film of its time, and Reese's Pieces sales blast off with it.
Yeah.
So Hershey's calls the deal the biggest marketing coup in history, and product placement becomes a staple in TV and movies thereafter. So that's the one that really launched. I mean, you see TV shows and movies now.
Yeah.
They've got products everywhere.
Sure.
And that's all paid placement. And that really hadn't happened to any great extent before E.T., but everybody picked up on, all the advertisers picked up on the success of Reese's Pieces, which was basically going nowhere, and they couldn't figure out what to do with it. It gets into the movie E.T., and now it's, now everybody knows who Reese's Pieces are.
Interesting.
It's amazing how that marketing blunder really cost, M&M's is still an extremely popular candy, but imagine what it could have been.
Yeah.
And then later on, they were sure to not miss any further opportunities, and they had, M&M's was sure to have on subsequent missions of U.S. space shuttles.
Sure.
They were sure to have M&M's floating around in the cabin and have that on video. Because they were so embarrassed by this, misstep with Reese's Pieces.
Yeah, then that's an example of a lesson well learned.
Yeah. Another marketing blunder.
There you go.
You know, so
it's This is fun, and this is just the tip of the iceberg as well.
Yeah, there's 92 others. We only did eight today.
Wow, well, it's a long way to go here. Well, it's called 100 of the Worst Ideas in History, yes. And that's really as far as you have to go right now. The website is 100 Worst Ideas. The 100 is not spelled out. It's the numerical 100, worstideas.com. And there you can get information, pick up the audiobook. If you're taking a car trip or something, or even commuting, this is a great way to entertain yourself and on the way back and forth.
Summer travel, waiting rooms, airports. It's also run, by the way, to get a shameless plug in.
Yes.
Excuse me, on Audible, Amazon, and iTunes. The printed book's available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Perfect. Hey, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I hope we can hook up again next time you put out another one. and I'm sure that'll happen.
Well, sure. Maybe next time, 100 of the best ideas in history. What do you think of that?
The worst really does pull them in, though. I got to tell you.
It's Schadenfreude, right? The glee you take in the misfortune of others. Yes, everybody loves that.
There you go. Yeah, I'm the front line for that one. Hey, pleasure speaking to you. One more time, it's 100worstideas.com. Pick up the audiobook. It's no reason not to. Well, that'll do it for me today. Thank you to my guests, and thank you to you. I'll be back again on Monday with a regular program, which I call regular. But until that time arrives, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I wish you peace.